The headlines: Iran and Syria renew their pledge to continue cooperation on fighting terrorism. Early results from local elections in England are out. The ruling Conservatives suffer huge losses, while Labour and the Liberal Democrats gain seats. And a gunman kills 8 people in Serbia in the country's second mass shooting in less than 48 hours. Hello and welcome. Your world news coming to you live from our headquarters in Tehran. My name is Gisum Shahmadi. Iran and Syria have issued a joint statement at the end of President Ibrahim Raisi's historic visit to the Arab country that took place on Wednesday and Thursday. The two sides have pledged to continue their strategic cooperation in all fields. The Iranian and Syrian governments agreed to expand bilateral cooperation, particularly in economy and trade. They also underlined the importance of cooperation to combat terrorism and extremism until all terror groups are completely wiped out. Iran and Syria strongly condemned the Israeli regime's aggression as a destabilizing factor in West Asia. They emphasized that Damascus has the right to respond to Tel Aviv's acts of aggression on Syria. The statement also denounced U.S. measures for looting Syria's natural resources, calling on the international community to bring to an end those measures. The statement, meanwhile, slammed unilateral coercive measures by the U.S. and the European Union against Iran and Syria. During his trip to Syria, President Raisi met senior officials and visited religious places. He is the first Iranian president visiting the Arab country in more than a decade.
Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi has attended an economic forum in Syria for Iranian and Syrian businessmen. He said that the two countries are determined to expand trade and economic partnerships, stressing that currently the bulk of trade exchange between Iran and Syria is unacceptable and should increase.
The will of both governments is to expand economic relations and eliminate obstacles in the way. This visit to Syria will constitute a positive turning point in developing relations with Syria, and you will see its impact on the economy of the two countries and the region.
This forum reflects Iran's and Syria's support for the private sector aimed at enhancing economic relations between the two countries. The viewpoint of presidents of both states was that such cooperation should be based on integration for the interests of the two nations.
Syrian and Iranian businessmen thanked their countries for the newly signed economic agreements. They said the war in Syria had blocked it from attracting investors, calling for the establishment of a joint bank, currency exchange companies, and an increase of air flights between the two states. Many of their requests were already dealt with, according to Iran's Minister of Roads and Urban Development.
Agreements signed recently aim to facilitate investments for businessmen. Agreements included establishing a joint bank and insurance system, as well as modifying tariffs on imports and exports. Good agreements were also reached in the transport sector. We will continue building the railway linking Iran, Iraq, and Syria for passengers and later on for goods.
On Wednesday, Iran and Syria signed an agreement on a long-term comprehensive strategic cooperation, as well as memorandums of understanding in the fields of oil, agriculture, rail and aerial transportation, free trade zones, earthquake reliefs, communications and information technologies. The Iranian president's visit to Syria has initiated a new phase of economic cooperation between the two countries. Both states are determined to upgrade mutual trade ties to reach the level of their strategic political relations. Muhammad Ali, Damascus.
Historian and journalist Bresh Yonker says that the Iranian president's visit to Syria sends a message that how things are normalized and stabilized in the Arab country following the years-long war there.
When you look at how much destroyed and occupied it was in the past decade, we're talking about there has been no visit by an Iranian president to Syria since 2011. And of course, this is for the simple reason that, especially since 2012, Syria was subjected to the fiercest and most brutal aggression that imaginable. This is aggression, of course, by a coalition of imperialist states in the West, by Zionist-backed terrorists, and by various groups of Wahhabi Takfiri. So when a country like that at a certain point in the past 10 years looked like it was almost ready to collapse and still pulled itself together, fought off all invaders and all occupiers, and now has been, for the most part, not entirely yet, unfortunately, but for the most part, liberated, and can now not just have, like, create new relations and new bonds with friendly nations, but also receive the president of the Islamic Republic of Iran within Damascus and go on all these, to sign on all these memoranda, all these agreements, and go to all these meetings and these gatherings. That shows that the normalization of the situation in Syria is definitely has come to a great extent. And it's not just Iran, of course, who has been meeting with Syrian officials, but even countries that Syria in the past was on almost hostile footing with have now had to accept that Syria will stand, that the Syrian Arab Republic has been victorious. So this is, and even the Emiratis and the Saudis and the Turks, they have had to accept the fact that Syria isn't going anywhere. And I think this meeting with Sayed Ibrahim Raisi in Damascus really shows to the world that the Syrian Arab Republic is here to stay. It is a stable government. It's a stable state that has fended off all aggression that has tried to topple it.
Iranian manufacturers have broken Western monopoly in producing turbo expanders, a centrifugal turbine that is widely used in oil and gas industry. The Shazan Petrochemical Company, located near the central city of Iraq, has produced the turbo expander. The company developed the system in cooperation with a knowledge-based Iranian firm. The achievement helps Iran save millions of dollars previously spent to import the system. It also puts the country on the list of the world's manufacturers of turbo expanders. Only three Western states have so far produced the system. Turbo expanders are very widely used as sources of refrigeration, industrial processes such as the extraction of ethane and natural gas liquids from natural gas. Early results from the Thursday local elections in England are coming. The ruling Conservatives are suffering losses, while the main opposition Labour Party is gaining more seats. Based on the early results, the Conservatives have so far lost 218 seats on local councils. Now, that is while the Labour has added 118 seats, making it confident that it will win the 2024 general elections. The Liberal Democrats and the Green Party have made gains as well. Final results are expected later today. They will decide more than 8,000 council seats in 230 local government authorities. The losses for the UK Conservatives come despite efforts by Prime Minister Rishi Sunak to restore the credibility of his party. The Conservatives have been facing public discontent over a range of issues, from political scandals to a worsening cost of living crisis. Our correspondent Said Purazan in London explains why the losses of the Conservatives in the last local elections are significant.
I think one of the things that voters had in mind while going to the polling stations was the cost of living crisis that has come about under Conservative rule for the past 12 or so years, and the periods of austerity that people have had to endure as a result of the policies of their conservative governments, successive conservative governments. It's important to look at how councils and seats are changing hands and where those changing of hands are taking place. One constituency, the former Prime Minister Theresa May's constituency, Windsor, now apparently taken over by Labour, that is very important, that's a conservative constituency. And now Labour has the majority seats there, which tells you a lot about the level of disaffection and dissatisfaction as far as the Conservative government is concerned. But as I say, we will have to wait until later in the day to have a clear picture of which way the results will go. But as for whether or not this is a litmus test or gives clues about how things will transpire as far as the general elections next year, it is at the same time a litmus test for the Labour Party. It's not just necessarily for the Conservatives.
Industrial orders have significantly fallen in Germany, raising fears that Europe's biggest economy is facing a sharp downturn. Based on official figures, new orders in March dropped by 10.7% compared to the previous month, and that is the biggest fall since April 2020, when COVID lockdowns and border closures took effect across the world. Official figures also show declines in most areas of Germany's manufacturing sector. Foreign orders were down by 13.3%, while domestic orders dropped 6.8% on the previous month. Some economists believe that the latest data are a real recession signal. The government, however, says key indicators are on an upward trend. New orders have just been very volatile in recent months. Thousands of employees from a major Italian telecoms operation have staged a day of strike against unbundling the company. Max Civilli reports.
On Thursday, about 6,000 employees from the Italian phone carrier Wind Tre walked out of work in protest against the management's decision to spin off the firm's network assets into a separate company. Wind Tre is the third largest Italian mobile operator with about 20 million customers and the second largest fixed line operator with almost 3 million subscribers. The industrial action had been called by Italy's three largest trade unions, CGL, CISL and UIL, against the unbundling deal, which unions and workers say is the prelude to mass layoffs.
We have to stand united against this spin-off. Breaking up companies always leads to detrimental consequences for workers. The best case scenario is that we get further stripped of working rights. The worst is thousands of layoffs.
The spin-off of telecoms operator Wind Tre will pave the way for the sale of a majority stake in the grid company to Swedish private equity firm EQT. Unionists say Wind Tre will shift some 2,000 workers out of a total 6,500 workers in Italy into the network venture.
Sta cambiando il modello industriale.
The industrial system as a whole is shifting towards a new paradigm in the communication sector, which features separating the management of the network grid from that of services. This way, Italy will further lose control on its strategic assets, and many smaller companies will kick in, exacerbating job insecurity in the country.
Job insecurity is rampant in Italy. According to statistical agency Eurostat's figures, Italy has the second lowest employment rate for young workers in Europe at about 30%. Also, Italy has no minimum wage but protects workers through collective agreements, which often remains a dead letter for people on precarious contracts. Meanwhile, Italy's government has scrapped an anti-poverty benefit that goes under the name of citizen income, replacing it with a more limited inclusion check for qualifying households starting from January 2024. Prime Minister Meloni argues that the citizen income, which helped about 4 million people last year, costs too much and discourages people, especially youths, from looking for jobs.
Personally, I have been forever looking for a dignifying job, but the only things I'm offered are badly paid long-hour jobs. The citizen income should have been amended, but not scrapped altogether.
Nearly half of workers aged between 30 and 34 in Italy have an income between 8,000 and 16,000 euro a year, an income bracket that ranges from absolute poverty to near subsistence. An increasing number of Italians are leaving the country in search of better opportunities abroad. Max Civilli, Rome.
A second mass shooting hit Serbia in less than 48 hours, leaving at least 8 people dead. The shooting took place in the town south of the capital, Belgrade. 13 people were wounded as well. Local media say Serbian police have arrested the suspect gunman. Still no official confirmation. Interior Minister has called the shooting a terrorist attack. President Aleksandar Vučić also expressed grief following the incident and called for stricter gun control measures. The shooting happened as Serbians were still shocked by another incident that took place on Wednesday. That shooting left 9 students dead after a 13-year-old boy opened fire at a school in Belgrade. He turned himself in. The Palestinian Authority has warned that Israel's daily assaults against Palestinians will destabilize the region and make things spiral out of control. The Palestinian Authority held the regime responsible for any escalation of violence across the Palestinian territories. It called on Israel's staunchest ally, the U.S., to push the regime into ending its crimes against Palestinians. On Thursday, the regime's forces killed a Palestinian woman near the city of Nablus over an alleged knife attack against Israelis. Hours earlier, they raided a Nablus neighborhood, killing three Palestinian men. Israel accused them of being behind an April attack that left two Israelis dead. Palestinians say their operations against Israelis are a natural response to the regime's atrocities. A new report suggests the number of people experiencing acute food insecurity and requiring urgent nutrition aid increased by 65 million across the globe in 2022. Our correspondent Rahmatullah Bahman reports from Kabul.
The number of people facing acute hunger and suffering from malnutrition is at its highest in 7 years. That, according to a recently published document, the Global Report on Food Crisis 2023. Last year, around 258 million people in 58 countries faced high levels of acute food insecurity, requiring urgent assistance. The report ranks Afghanistan as one of the five countries facing the worst levels of hunger, and one of the seven territories grappling with starvation. In Afghanistan, 19 million people faced acute food insecurity at crisis or worse levels, according to the FAO report. More than 20,000 Afghans experienced catastrophe at some point during 2022.
This situation leaves me shocked and crying. When they come to me and ask for food aid, I don't know how to reply. Like this family you just visited, there are 20,000 others in this district. Most of their children and women are malnourished. They are collecting waste to make a living. I'm afraid they are facing a humanitarian calamity without immediate aid.
The report highlights conflict, economic shocks, and climate extremes as key drivers of food insecurity. In Afghanistan, these global disasters coincided with a crippling economy, major cuts in aid, and the U.S. sanctions. Afghanistan faces a humanitarian crisis as political and economic turmoil grips the country. Experts urge immediate action to prevent widespread hunger and suffering among the population. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
And now with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of the speech delivered by Ayatollah Khamenei in a meeting with Iranian officials and the ambassadors of Islamic countries on the auspicious occasion of Eid al-Fitr on April 22, 2023. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. All praise is due to God, Lord of the worlds. And peace and greetings be upon our Master, Muhammad, and upon his pure progeny, particularly the remnant of God on earth. I would like to congratulate all the respected people here in this meeting, including the heads of Iran's executive branches, our officials, and the ambassadors and representatives of Islamic countries on the auspicious occasion of Eid al-Fitr. I would also like to congratulate the entire Iranian nation, who are truly deserving of congratulations because of their behaviour and their meritorious deeds during the month of Ramadan. I would also like to extend my congratulations to all of the Muslims in the world and the entire Islamic nation. I hope that the Almighty God will bless everyone during this Eid. The month of Ramadan provides the environment for hearts to become closer to each other.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
All of the various dimensions of the month of Ramadan help to bring the hearts of people closer to each other, both within the country and within the entire Islamic Ummah. First of all, the tenderness that is created in people by their fasting, prayers, supplications, and recitation of the Qur'an is itself a source for bringing the hearts closer together. And piety brings hearts together, just as the President pointed out in his statements. He stated this very well when he said that the secret to fasting is piety. In my opinion, the officials of Islamic countries should use this opportunity to increase unity and closeness among the members of the Islamic nation. Our problem today is division. Even though the Qur'an prohibits division, do not be like those who became divided into sects and differed. The Holy Qur'an, Surah 3, verse 105. And it commands us to be united. وَاعْتَصِمُوا بِحَبْلِ اللَّهِ جَمِيعًا وَلَا تَفَرَّقُوا. Hold fast altogether to Allah's rope, and do not be divided. The Holy Qur'an, Surah 3, verse 103. The members of the Islamic nation, the Islamic Ummah, are divided. Yes, there are different opinions, there are different sects, and there are different tastes. That's fine, but these different tastes do not mean that we should be deprived of the great blessings of the Islamic nation being united.
Allah, I want to thank you. That you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Is be true to what you said on paper.
We won't back down.
Stop the witching.
Turn here now.
We will resist.
I can't breathe. Help me. Please.
We the people.
LaShawn Thompson was found dead in his cell in an Atlanta jail with more than 1,000 insect bites all over his body. His body was discovered in a filthy jail cell in September, ignored by medical staff and eaten by insects and bugs. The United States holds the most prisoners in the world. Many of the thousands of prisons, jails, and correctional facilities around the country are in deplorable and inhumane conditions. Millions of Americans are held in these facilities with little hope of staying out after being released, since most find their way back to prison one way or another. hellhole. The United States is home to the world's largest prison system, with close to 2 million people behind bars. The conditions in U.S. jails and prisons are often inhumane, with overcrowding, violence, and inadequate health care plaguing the system. Many prisoners are also subject to long periods of solitary confinement, which can cause severe mental and physical harm. The massive number of prisoners are held in 1,566 state prisons, 98 federal prisons, 3,116 local jails, 1,323 juvenile correctional facilities, 181 immigration detention facilities, and 80 Indian country jails, as well as military prisons, civil commitment centers, state psychiatric hospitals, and prisons in U.S. territories. LaShawn Thompson was held in one of the thousands of these facilities, left to die and eaten alive by bugs and insects.
The image is hard to look at. 35-year-old LaShawn Thompson, unresponsive in a Fulton County jail cell, covered in what his family's attorney says are insect and bedbug bites.
The scene was so horrific that the detention officer said she would not even administer CPR when they found him because she was freaked out. In her words, freaked out by the thing.
Thompson suffered from mental health issues and was diagnosed with schizophrenia. He was placed in a psychiatric ward in jail 3 months before his death. Prisoners in the U.S. face significant barriers to accessing adequate health care. Many prisoners suffer from chronic illnesses such as diabetes and heart disease, but are often denied necessary medication and treatment. The result is that many prisoners suffer unnecessarily and are at risk of dying from preventable illnesses.
They are overcrowded, they are underfunded. In many cases, the way they're designed, the newer ones even, the way they're designed, they're putting a bunch of people in these pods in these areas, these community areas, with the cells attached, where they pretty much have to police themselves within the pods, within the tiers, which is what you see in places like El Salvador, maybe in countries where they just put people away in these facilities and then they basically just lock them away. And that's kind of what you're getting these days on a smaller scale, on a more unique, individualized scale in these jails. What happened with LaShawn Thompson is unbelievable. It is immoral. It is amoral. And it must not be allowed to continue.
The result of the official autopsy carried out on LaShawn Thompson came out as, quote, undetermined, end quote. Now autopsies cost between $20,000 to $50,000, and Thompson's family would not be able to afford it.
Those behind bars receive from guards and deputies who patrol an indisputable exclusive found Dylan Camerod was beaten by officers at a Michigan jail. He was a former MMA fighter. In 2019, Terry Whitehead would be beaten by former corrections officer David M. Schwartz. These punishments happen at all times of the day.
One factor contributing to the crisis in U.S. jails and prisons is a lack of focus on rehabilitation and reintegration. Many prisoners are released back into society without the necessary skills or resources to succeed, leading to high rates of recidivism. Moreover, many former prisoners are unable to secure employment or housing due to their criminal record, perpetuating a cycle of poverty and crime. And without greater investment in education, job training, and mental health care, this cycle is likely to continue.
All of a sudden you're pulled over, you're taken into custody. Often your family is not notified for hours, if not days thereafter. And because of the pretrial system that exists in America, if you do not have money to bond out, or if you do not have someone who can post a cash bond for you to be released, you have to stay in custody until such time as you can go to trial. During this period of time, as you can imagine, you've often lost your job if you had a job. You've lost your car if you had car payments. You've lost your apartment if you needed to pay rent. All of your possessions have been either thrown out or auctioned off. Even if you are found not guilty and do not proceed to prison, your life often has to be restarted from scratch as a result of charges against you because of the barriers to justice that exist in America.
The disproportionate impact of the U.S. prison system on marginalized communities must be addressed. Black and Latino individuals are incarcerated at significantly higher rates than white individuals, often as a result of systemic racism and poverty. The result is that these communities are disproportionately affected by the negative impacts of the prison system, including the perpetuation of poverty and the destruction of families. How does mass incarceration affect African American communities?
I know a lot of people who are real activists in this cause have been incarcerated before, and I'm one of them. I was incarcerated for a year in Richmond and for about a month here in Tampa. This is a long time ago. But I can tell you that from that time, in places where you, cities where you don't particularly think of African Americans as the majority, in the prison population, they certainly are. So I've seen this firsthand. Yes, it is a disproportionate percentage of the population in the prisons, in jails, in the penal system. And the cost on the communities is extensive. There's the cost of family members having to take care of them. There's the cost of constantly worrying about the future of what's going to happen to you. There's the cost that when young people see it as possible, as more likely in their community, their future will be in a prison rather than in a college. And it is based on the reality in which they live. The cost of that is extensive.
The U.S. prison system is a profitable industry. Prisons and correctional facilities across the country generate billions of dollars in revenue each year, largely through the incarceration of individuals. One way in which prisons make money is through the use of inmate labor. Prisoners are often forced to work in various industries, including manufacturing, agriculture, and call centers, without any real compensation. So does inmate labor resemble slavery?
Ava DuVernay, the filmmaker, had a documentary several years ago called The 13th, about the 13th Amendment, which the post-Civil War amendments, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, were meant to end slavery, to give constitutional rights to African Americans, and to give them the right to vote. However, states and federal prisons have found ways to abrogate this prohibition against slavery through the inmate labor system. Inmates are often contracted to work in state projects for pennies and hours, same wages that you would expect in any slave camp around the world. We're talking about printing license plates for 5 cents an hour, doing landscaping projects. There was a scheme in Georgia several years ago to ban illegal immigrant labor in America and then replace that with cheap prison labor in order to help the agricultural industry. This is clearly an effort to reinstitute the type of serfdom and plebiscite labor that was very endemic after the Civil War in the United States of America.
In addition, private prisons have become an increasingly popular way to profit off of incarceration. These for-profit facilities are owned and operated by private companies who get into contracts with state and federal governments to house inmates. Private prisons often prioritize profits over rehabilitation and safety, leading to lower standards of care and increased violence within the facilities. So how does the profit-driven U.S. prison system affect the quality of the care of inmates?
Administration. America went through this process of privatization of the prison system. As a result, the states now pay private prisons to incarcerate individuals. Then these prisons are paid by the number of people that they can keep in those prison cells. So there's a perverse incentive to keep people locked up and to keep them locked up longer. And because you have a profit-driven capitalistic model, of course prisons are incentivized as for-profit companies to provide the most substandard care possible. Because there are very few rights that are accorded to prisoners, because there are very few opportunities to complain or to be heard for prisoners, because they're often pariahs in society.
The profit-driven nature of the U.S. prison system has led to a number of ethical concerns, including questions about the quality of care provided to incarcerated individuals, the impact on communities and families, and the role of private corporations in the criminal justice system. Critics argue that the profit motive creates perverse incentives to incarcerate more individuals, limit access to rehabilitation services, and cut corners on safety and health standards.
Along with the privatization comes deregulation, and nobody is looking into it. Nobody is checking up. It's like the case with LaShawn. How could that possibly have come to that kind of nightmare where that young man was living for that long? How could that have happened in our system? And the answer to that question is nobody was looking. Nobody was looking because it doesn't profit them to see the blemishes, to see the holes in the system. It doesn't. That's what privatization of prisons does. It turns it into a, it's not a moral question anymore. It's one of business. And there are no morals in business.
Perhaps one of the most controversial aspects of the U.S. prison system is the use of solitary confinement. Many prisoners are placed in solitary confinement for extended periods, sometimes for years at a time. This practice is known to cause severe mental and physical harm, leading to long-term mental health problems and even suicide. Despite this, the use of solitary confinement continues to be widespread in U.S. prisons, often as a form of punishment for minor infractions.
6 foot by 9. For 23 hours a day.
I wake up soaking wet, sweating sometime.
For decade after decade.
I just feel as though you're being squeezed to death.
Now imagine doing all of that alone. It is a reality for tens of thousands of prisoners in America.
Solitary confinement is a practice of isolating inmates in a cell for 22 to 24 hours a day, with limited or no human interaction, exercise, or access to educational or recreational programs. In the U.S., it's estimated that around 80,000 prisoners are held in solitary confinement on any given day. The practice is controversial, and many human rights organizations, medical experts, and lawmakers have called for its abolition, citing its detrimental effects on mental health and rehabilitation.
Solitary confinement is a clear violation of the United States Constitution. In spite of this, it is often used as a method for inmate control for individuals who are incarcerated. The Eighth Amendment has a clear prohibition against cruel and unusual punishment. I think that any rational person would say that locking a human being away in a concrete cell with no access to sunlight, no access to fresh running water, no human interaction for up to 20 hours or 22 hours a day with very short respites in order to step outside, eat, and often defecate would be a cruel and unusual punishment. The effects of these can be often long-term, if not lifetime, mental health damage as a result of solitary confinement. Inmates who have returned home have talked about having post-traumatic stress disorder. They've talked about the trauma, the nightmares that persist throughout the remainder of their lives, the inability to function and interact with human beings, the inability to form relationships after being locked away in confinement of that nature, well, for sometimes years at a time. The jails use the excuse that is about controlling the inmate population. However, because of the constitutional prohibition against cruel and unusual punishment, this should not be allowed. It would not be allowed.
An Indiana inmate, Joshua McLemore, lost 45 pounds over 20 days of solitary confinement and basically starved to death in 2021. 28-year-old McLemore was mentally ill and placed naked in solitary confinement without any medical or mental care after he had pulled a nurse's hair in the hospital. Video surveillance shows he would go into psychosis episodes, and Jackson County jail staff do nothing for him while he slowly deteriorates and dies.
Confinement is a way to turn a borderline criminal, misdemeanor type criminal into a felon. It's torture. It's the antithesis for what you want to do. The point of prison isn't just to punish. The point of prison is to rehabilitate so that you don't have recidivism. You don't have people coming back into the prison system every time you open the door and let them back out. It's not just a fear model, but it's a rehabilitation model. And so many countries all across the world do such a better job with recidivism, with keeping people from going back into the jails, getting people ready to become part of the communities and feel connected to the communities. If you isolate somebody for, I mean, we're talking in some cases years they keep people in isolation. This isolation technique, this was something that was used in prison camps during wars or prisoner of wars, where you would isolate people and you would put them and lock them away in little cells for years and years until the end of the war. It creates monsters.
The U.S. prison system must address the issue of racial bias and discrimination. Black and Latino individuals are disproportionately represented in the prison population, often as a result of systemic racism in law enforcement and the justice system. This is evident in the harsher sentences imposed on people of color for the same crimes as their white counterparts. Nothing has been truly done to address this issue, and as the years go by, the situation seems to get only worse.
Indeed, the founding document of America, the Constitution, enshrines within it that African Americans will be treated as 3/5 of a human being for purposes of representation in the United States. This system of oppression of African Americans has continued until the present day, because what we have found is that in America there is a clear correlation between poverty, between education, between health care, and further incarceration later in life. Because of this, when you look at the historic system of oppression of African Americans, the lack of access to proper housing through systems of redlining, the lack of access to job opportunities through racism and segregation, the lack of access to health care and educational opportunities through segregation and substandard schooling systems, this has led directly to the place what we see right now, where you have a disproportionate representation of African Americans in the nearly 2.2 million people in the United States who are currently incarcerated. You have a system that is in place which puts barriers to justice, particularly along racial lines in the United States of America. And the fact that there is no appetite to handle these issues, that there has been nothing along the lines of a Truth and Reconciliation Council, there's been nothing along the lines of a conversation or even an apology from the United States government for slavery and segregation.
In the United States, they call solitary confinement the Secure Housing Unit or the SHU program, which is the Special Holding Unit, or they call it simply the hole. Prisoners are held in the hole for punishment, security reasons, or simply because they're being transferred to another prison. In a country with only 10 cities with populations over a million, jails and prisons in America hold more than 2 million people. Going to the hole in U.S. prisons for months is very common, and many Americans who have been incarcerated know that they will probably someday end up back in the hellhole.
Peace, and welcome back to Power to the People. On today's episode, we are going to take a look at the American prison system and how it's been a genocidal death camp since its inception. First and foremost, the American prison system is a genocidal system that has its roots in the enslavement of Africans through chattel slavery. It is a murderous system that continues to kill people day in and day out, and it's been doing this since the founding of this country. And the foundation of the American economy is literally based on chattel slavery, which evolved into the modern day prison plantation system that we see today. Just like its predecessor of chattel slavery, the prison system, it enslaves people and forces them to work for pennies in comparison to the labor and products that are being produced. This has all been legalized through the good old 13th Amendment of the Constitution, which legalizes slavery when one is being punished for a crime. Almost instantaneously after this amendment to the Constitution was made, being black and simply breathing was criminal. And today, more than a third of black men are under correctional control, which is literally more than was enslaved during chattel slavery. By doing this, it's literally created a revolving door for black men to go in and out of prisons, which is profitable for America. The legalization of slavery, it allows for the government and corporations to rake in billions upon trillions of dollars in profit. People can literally get jobs the first day in prison, but can't find jobs when they are out in the streets. And the conditions of prisons in the United States are beyond humane. These prisons, they wouldn't even be considered humane for animals. These American prisons are essentially a death camp. In 2019, a total of 1,200 people died in local jails, and 77% of the 1,200 people who died in these jails were not convicted of a crime. And more data, it shows that in 2020, there were 6,182 deaths, which was a 61% increase to the prior year. And this is all happening despite the fact that the prison population dropped 10%. A recent example of a case that has gotten national attention is the tragic and inhumane and torturous death of LaShawn Thompson. LaShawn was found dead in a jail cell, and according to the Thompson family's attorney, he was eaten alive by insects and bedbugs. And photos of his body, they show his body completely ravaged by insect bites. What else do we call this other than genocidal terrorism? It's something completely evil and satanic that prison guards will literally watch and let a person be murdered by insects. Yet America itself, it continually tries to play like it's some good guy and like it's on some type of moral high ground. But in the belly of the beast inside America, the U.S. government is systematically killing its own quote-unquote citizens in the prisons and in the streets. The question is, why aren't people in America standing up? Why is it that the average American will say we need to go and get and install justice in other countries when America herself is the biggest Satan of them all? It can truly be said that to believe in the state of America is to be in a state of delusion, because America is a genocidal nation that has blood on its hands, not only within this country, but throughout the world too. This is Power to the People.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
The Last Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show us the sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah. To the redeemer of human volition and thought.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome. You're listening to The Last Savior. This is your host, Zainab Askari. Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him and his purified family, said, "If a person does not know the Imam of his time, the person will die the death of an ignorant." Which means it makes us, for us, very important to know about the Imam of our time, because whatever the degrees we are amassing, holding, collecting, and at the same time not knowing about the Imam of our time, it's as good as being ignorant. May Allah not make us among those who die the death of an ignorant. So in this program, we try to make sure that we provide you with the maximum possible information about the Imam of our time. On that note, today in our studio, we have with us guest speaker, the Islamic researcher, Dr. Ali Alavi. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome, sir.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to me to be here.
So, dear listeners, we have had the pleasure to be with Dr. Ali Alavi, and now we are going to start a series of questions with Dr. Ali Alavi, which are very basic questions to know about our Imam. Well, before we get into that, Dr. Alavi, I would want to ask you, there's a difference when we talk about Imam. Like, who is Imam? What is the definition of Imam? Because for Shias, Imam is someone, and for Sunnis, there's a different definition of Imam. So how do you define an Imam?
Yes, as you rightly mentioned, we are trying to focus on 40 critical questions with regard to the existence of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. But with your introduction, we need to know first who the Imam is and what is the status of Imamate or Imama. The status of Imamate is actually the same as prophecy, Nubuwa, but this and the continuation of that level of prophecy.
So is the only difference that there's no revelation in Imamate?
Definitely, there is no. I'll get to that point, inshallah. Sure. So we said that it is in the continuation of the same status, that is prophecy, that is called Imamate. The same reason that we need the Prophet for the guidance of the mankind, for the same reason we need Imam. There are some differences on their mission and on what is coming to them and what not coming to them. But we are now talking about the necessity of the status of Imamate. Yes, the basic difference is that revelation is not coming to the Imam, but the revelation in the sense that wahi that comes to the Holy Prophet, which is going to be like a transcript, yes, is not coming to Imam. But the reason that we are in need of an infallible Imam is due to the deficiencies of our intellect, our aql. So the aql actually has lots of deficiencies and lots of problems, and that cannot answer all the questions that a human being has. So there is something that comes to help that person, that humanity, that, and that is the infallible Imam. So this, why are you insisting on the infallibility of this person? And what is wrong with the intellect itself? So if any of us has ever actually felt sorry about an issue, for example, we did an action and then later on we felt sorry that why did we do it? It means that we made a mistake,
we
right?
We have regrets within us.
We have regrets.
Yeah.
And also we see in the society there are lots of cases of, for example, divorce. Due to some, I don't know, a mistake in the decision that was made, for example, in a certain point of time.
Yeah.
So it means that, yes, our intellect is not by itself that comprehensive to see all the consequences of all the actions that he is actually afflicted with. So he or she is in need of an infallible person to help him to cover the deficiencies of the intellect of the human being.
All right.
That is the reason of the existence of human. But
all right. Well,
I want to say, just sorry for an interruption, I just want to say that in this series of shows that we are starting from today, we are going to actually provide just short answers to these questions to, inshallah, be able to cover a series of questions that we are
inshallah.
In.
So before we proceed further, let's take a short break and we'll come back in a while.
I can feel your eyes like the sun shining behind the clouds. I need a morning to shatter this long night forever. I need a hero to stop this thousand-year-old
Welcome back. You're listening to The Last Savior, and we have Dr. Ali Alavi with us in the studio, and we're discussing some very basic questions about Mehtaviyat. Yes, doctor.
Yeah, we said that why do we say that intellect has some deficiencies that is not capable, is not able to, for example, provide the answers for his solutions, for his issues, and to find solutions for the cases that he is inflicted with? We can say that the human intellect is like Goldsmith's scale, like the scale that actually is able to measure small things. But for, let's say, weighty things, a bigger or greater scales are needed. So we are in need of, let's say, a comprehensive scale to give us this ability to weigh everything, to measure everything, that even if it is weighty. So this imam, this person who is going to be a leader, call it an imam or a prophet. We are talking about imam because we have reached to the end of prophecy, because we know that the Holy Prophet is Khatam al-Anbiya.
Yeah.
That is the end of the prophets. That's why we are now talking about the concept of imamate rather than the prophecy. So this person needs to have some characteristics and features. He has to be a person who knows the experiences of people from past and present and future.
All right.
This person needs to be a free person, not under the pressure of any political or social, let's say, current or, let's say, party.
Yeah.
And he is aware of consequences of different, let's say, waves and currents of politics and, let's say, economy and all different
political
aspects
moment.
Of movements, whether in political issues or, let's say, economic and others. So he needs to have access to the ilm of the unseen, knowledge of ghaib. He has to have access to that. And it is actually something which is quite necessary for an imam to be aware of.
All right.
So he has the knowledge of, as I said, past and present and even the future. And this person who is equipped with the knowledge of ghaib is actually not going to think of himself and to, for example, judge based on his own desires and his own experience. Rather, he's acting based on what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala put on his shoulder.
So being self-centered is one of the things that is should not be there in imam.
Yeah.
There might be definitely many other characteristics which we would want to know, but let's take a short break and we'll be back. Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is The Last Savior. We have had the pleasure to be with Dr. Ali Alavi today, and we're discussing very basic concepts about Mehtaviyat, and we're going to discuss some 40 critical questions on this issue. But here we are discussing some of the basic things first before we get into the discussion. Dr. Alavi, you were talking about the characteristics an imam should be having. The first thing that you made clear to us is that imam is someone who is thinking about each and every person. He is not a self-centered person.